Let me introduce myself. My name is Ron Large, and some of you might have read the little blurb on the bulletin board about who I am, but I'll say a little bit more. I teach at Gonzaga University, which is in Spokane, Washington. I have to say that not everybody necessarily knows where Spokane is, but it's in the eastern part of the state, not too far from the Washington-Idaho border. I teach in the Religious Studies Department. My field is ethics, and specifically areas of war, peace, violence, nonviolence, and those sorts of issues. I did my doctoral dissertation on Gandhi and Martin Luther King, so I've been working in that area for a long time. What I want to want you to do. I'll say a little bit more about myself in just a minute, but if there's any questions, comments, there'll be, you know, obviously opportunity for discussion, but you know, feel free at any moment, if the spirit moves you, to put your hand up and ask a question or if a comment or something you want to say. I have some books up here, as I mentioned, two of which are in the bookstore that I asked them to order. One is the Challenge of Peace, which is the Catholic Bishop's pastoral letter on war and peace that was done in 1983. It's moderately Catholic in a way, but it also, I think, deals certainly with, in terms of just war theory, in a really concise way. It gives you a pretty good explanation of what just war theory is like and its criteria and conditions, and I'm going to talk more about that tomorrow. And the other one in the bookstore is called The Warriors, by a man named John Glenn Gray. Gray was, he received his PhD and his draft notice for World War II on the same day, and served in Army Intelligence during most of the war, and he got his PhD in philosophy, so he kept a journal during the war, and the book is excerpts from his journal with extended commentary on his experiences in the war, and it's one of the best personal accounts, reflective personal accounts on war that I've read. It's an excellent book, and a couple of things that Gray talks about, I'll be doing some things on later in the week too. Yes, World War II. Right. And then there's some other ones, and I won't go through them, at least not yet. Maybe afterward I'll say something about them. There's a good selection on war and peace issues in the bookstore, by the way, if you're interested. There's a lot of good works up there. Well, one I'll just mention quickly, John Howard Yoder. Some of you might know him. Teaches at Notre Dame. He's a pacifist, Mennonite. And this book is in the bookstore. It's called When War is Unjust, and it's about the application of just war theory. And then I guess I might as well mention Martin Luther. There is a book that I have called Selected Political Writings, and some of those deal with war. I guess the two of the most predominant ones would be Against the Robbing and Murdering Hordes of Peasants. We don't like to talk about that one, but that's in there. And then Whether or Not Soldiers Can Be Saved. So what I'd like you to do for just about a minute is to think about the ways in which Christians have evaluated war, thought about war, their conclusions they've drawn about war, and just think about some of the ways in which war has been, as I said, evaluated, described, understood, either throughout history or just your own personal sense of war. And what I'd like you to do is take a minute, think about that. And then we'll come back and I'll put a few things on the board and just see sort of what range we have in terms of reflections on war and thinking about warfare. And then we'll see if we can make some organizes a little bit more systematically. So I want to do that first to just sort of see where we are. And then what I'd like to do is talk about the three general attitudes or approaches that Christians have taken toward warfare. Some of you are familiar with, and I'll expand on them a little bit. But take about a minute, maybe a little less. And just think about that. Your own reflection on warfare, your evaluation of it, or just Christians in general. So when I ask you for your comments, they don't necessarily have to be personally your own, just in terms of the way war has been thought about. So take, as I said, about a minute. Think about that. Did anyone go to the morning talk with David and Ann Woodward? And they talked about the Gulf War. Well, let's put some things down. What ways, or what can we say about it? What, how do we evaluate it? What's our opinion about war attitude? Yeah.
Well, what comes to my mind is this poem about ours not to wonder by, ours but to do or die.
Well,
into
okay.
The battle of death, road to 600.
So there's a question here.
I forget who did it, but.
That? Total obedience? I'll just have to flatten it out there. How's that? Do or die, total obedience.
What else about warfare?
Well, I've experienced World War II and the Korean and the Vietnam War, and we have wars that I would say that when military men are allowed to fight a war and bring it to a conclusion, and then we get a political war where the military are not allowed to do the job that they're taught to do in a military school.
Okay.
So we got a conflict of what different types of war.
Let's just say that political. Is that more legible? Political and military wars. And the difference obviously being in terms of, let's just say this. In terms of achieving victory and what that implies. What else? What else about warfare?
I think warfare is probably the most un-Christ-like activity in which humans participate.
Why? Well, I mean, what makes you say that? I mean, what's the... Okay.
And all the killing that does psychologically.
All right, so killing in both in, obviously, physical, and you mentioned psychological. Psychological.
That's good. Yes?
I come up with that hymn, we're not the right man on our side, the man of God, don't you think that? You know, God is on our side and we can't help it.
All right. I'll just say God on our side. So in that sense, you said, void. It's unavoidable.
It can't be helped.
He would approve if that's to me.
God would approve?
God on our side,
okay.
He would approve.
All right, God approves.
What am I?
The term.
Sure, well, so yes.
We're not following the commandments. Thou shalt not kill, we should love our neighbor as thyself.
Right.
You know.
Ten Commandments. Yes.
It's a terrible waste of lives and resources. God given resources.
Waste, lives, and resources.
What else? Anything else? This is a good list. It's going to help me a lot. Yes.
Well, sure. Jesus said, love your enemies.
Okay.
we can usually rationalize a reason for war.
Two different things going on there in a sense, reasons and the rationalization process that gets us there. I want to talk about some of those too. Running out of space. Anything else? Anybody wants to add to that?
A lot of times, I mean, we might be Christians, but we're fighting other religions, religious type people.
All right.
Religious wars?
Yeah, let me just say that. Yeah. So we could have put maybe that down here with political, military, and religious. Different types of, if you want to characterize different types of warfare, we could do it that way. Yeah. Anyone, anything else?
Well, I know in World War II, Hitler was perceived as so evil that a group of Germans tried to kill him, and then weren't they done away with themselves?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's that kind of
perception
of evil and the individual action that's required of it?
All right, let's do this. Total evil and the confrontation with evil. Part of that might fit in with this notion of it being unavoidable. If you look at this list, I mean, there's a whole range of sort of categories here that we can talk about, ranging all the way from war being unchristlike, all the way to saying God approves. I mean, it's hard for me to see anything that would, you know, fit in between there in those terms of those two extremes. Okay? On one hand, the idea that this is something that Christians simply should not do, cannot do, or at least it certainly carries a lot of moral weight attached to it, all the way to the other side where it just seems to be completely acceptable. There's no really negative evaluation attached to it at all. And it should come as no surprise that that is precisely the way in which Christians have thought about war all along. I mean, I guess the thing I want to say about sort of the background to this, there really hasn't been sort of one Christian view of warfare and then another and then another. I mean, all of these have gone along almost on parallel tracks. So you can't point to one period in Christian history or the history of the church and say, well, at one point it was this way, and then it shifted, and then it was this. I mean, sometimes one viewpoint predominates, maybe a little bit more, but if you really read the material and look at it, you're going to see this, as I said, sort of parallel development. Yeah?
Well, we don't consider Old Testament Christian period.
Well, that's another part of the ambiguity of this. Because one of the ways in which Christians have interpreted warfare is in sort of this, the whole old and new kind of transition, where the Old Testament, you have Yahweh as the warrior God, and then that shifts, and then you have the new, and then war is overcome, or with Christ now, it's a new era, a new aeon, and it's different now. There's a good book, I wish I could remember the name of the author, it's called Yahweh as Warrior. And it's an analysis of warfare in the Old Testament. I can't remember the name of the author. Does anyone know? If I think about it, it might pop into my head, and I'll think about it. But one of the things that I think is interesting with that, it's almost a way in which, sort of Christian triumphalism in a way, that the battle Hebrews had war and we don't. You know, we've gone beyond that. Historically, theologically speaking, I don't know, maybe we could say something like that, but boy, historically speaking, it's just not the case. I mean, most wars have been fought, at least in the last millennium or so, by Christians. So, I think we need to be careful about the separation between the Hebrew Scriptures and the Gospel and the New Testament in terms of the way in which war is understood. I will say maybe just one more quick thing about that. Part of this is the debate that centers on Joshua and Judges and the conquest of Canaan. And the idea there about God giving the land to the people and then taking it over. But even there you get ambiguity. Because on one hand you get the sense of this really quick conquest, you know, a lot of battles, war, and on the other hand it's a much slower process. Yoder talks a little bit about some of that in this book called The Original Revolution. He has a discussion of the Old Testament and war. I want to come back to some of these. If we can pull out at least some that are similar. Obviously the idea unchristlike, violation of the Ten Commandments, Jesus, love your enemies, and then the evaluation of that possibly in terms of war being a waste of lives and resources. There is obviously a tradition in Christianity that in which those values and those ideas predominate, and that's the pacifist tradition. And that's the first major category that, you know, I'm going to take a quick look at. As I said, these are not separate, distinct periods. In other words, I want to talk about three major categories about warfare, but they do develop along at the same time. Pacifism, yes, essentially is the idea taking certain values in the gospel, certain understanding of God's demands, and a certain sort of interpretation of that, and making this kind of argument. Killing is wrong, war is killing, and so what's the conclusion?
War
is wrong. Yeah, I mean, it's your old syllogism if you ever studied logic. But that's basically what's going on behind that. It's looking at the nature of warfare, what it involves, and then you have a moral evaluation of that, and then you draw the conclusion from it. And the argument then that warfare is wrong. Okay. Now, where does that come from? I mentioned, sort of hinted at the Gospels in the New Testament. Let me say just a little bit more about that. There's really sort of two views on the sources of Christian pacifism and why it developed. There's sort of an old view and a new view. Let me tell you the old view. The old view was that the early church was fundamentally and predominantly pacifist, opposed to war almost entirely, completely. Okay? And then you get a shift that occurs a little bit later, and the idea of pacifism begins to fade a little bit. The new view argues that that's overly simplistic and that you can't simply lump the early church in that pacifist context in terms of its attitude toward war. It's much more complex than that. I have a friend that, the reason I know about this, he was telling me about it. A friend teaches at North Dakota State in Fargo and is an expert on Roman military history. And he also has his degree in church history. And one of the things he's done is gone back and looked at a lot of the Roman records. And what he's come to conclude is that there was much more Christian participation in the military earlier, much earlier than we thought. I would argue, he would argue that that goes to show that the early church was not pacifist. I think he's overstating it a bit. I would still argue that pacifism was certainly a dominant viewpoint in the early church, but clearly not as much as we were once led to believe. He also argues that there's another reason for the pacifism of the early church, and that has to do with its apocalyptic vision of the second coming in which the enemies would be wiped out and destroyed. So they could be pacifists now because God would come back and do it later for them. Okay. Now that's not a very nice way to look at if you're going to be a pacifist, that's probably not a good way to ground your pacifism. But he argues that those apocalyptic images also influenced the church's attitude toward warfare. In other words, we don't need to engage in this now, because a little bit later on, when the end comes, God will take care of it. So you're moving really into this, but it's not the Christians are taking an active role in that. They're going to wait for it to happen at some point. Okay. There's another reason, too, for pacifism in the early church. And that has to do not with moral reasons, necessarily, about killing being wrong, but with religious reasons. Now, if you're think about this. If you're in the Roman army, what does that mean religiously?
Christian.
Well, think about that. What was Roman religion? Yes, all right. Polytheistic, pagan. And they all had, the military had their own gods, their own rituals, their own forms of worship. So participating in that would be a form of idolatry. So there was that reason as well, although there were, as I said, Christians in the military at the time. So there was this participation in the military and in war, but I would argue that it wasn't sort of the general position or approach or attitude of the church. But it does begin to change. And let me give you a couple of interesting sort of trivia items, I guess. By the year 416, only Christians were permitted to serve in the military. Almost a complete reversal.
This is in the Roman military?
Yes. Well, that's the problem, because a lot of this is tied up with Constantine and his attempt to unify the empire and using Christianity as part of that. Okay. So you get then, I hadn't thought about it, but you might use this term, the Christianization of the military as a consequence of what Constantine wanted to do politically. And by about 600, the idea began to develop that Christians who die in battle became martyrs. Okay. And then that progresses up into the Middle Ages, where you have the ideal of the Christian knight as, again, kind of the epitome of virtue. But warfare, you know, strongly associated with that. Okay. Now, what's been happening to pacifism in this sort of in this period? It's still there. As I said, it's not like one idea then the next. They're developing along parallel lines. And pacifism begins to resurface much more explicitly during the Reformation, and particularly with a group. I'm sure you probably know. I'm about to write it down. A group that we call Anabaptists. More specifically, probably the Mennonites and Menno Simons. And then a little bit later after that, Quakers and the Amish. Those three are what make up what we call the traditional peace churches. And most of our modern notions of pacifism, at least from a religious standpoint, really come from there in the Radical Reformation out of the Anabaptists. The Anabaptists simply made this argument, or the Mennonites. The idea was that for them, they wanted a return to the New Testament church. And their understanding of that was very much dominated by these images about what Jesus required, about loving your enemies, what that meant in terms of an attitude or an evaluation of war, participation in warfare. Okay. And so consequently, looking at that, they just simply made the argument that pacifism is what the New Testament demands. Okay. Now, and as I said, most of our modern views of pacifism come out of that conscientious objection in terms of an attitude or a status, in terms of thinking about warfare, really comes out of that development, our modern ideas about pacifism. Okay. Today, I don't know, what can I say about pacifism today? It's still here, obviously. There are different types and varieties as well. Just to give you one quick example, there's people that might call themselves nuclear pacifists. Do you know what that might mean? If someone's a nuclear pacifist, what does that mean?
You can go ahead and kill each other with conventional weapons, but don't use atomic weapons, because they might splash onto me.
Yeah, basically that's right. I mean, it's making evaluations not of warfare overall, but of different kinds of war, and making the argument that one kind of warfare, conventional, okay, might be acceptable.
Okay.
We could maybe quibble about that.
Or someplace else.
Yeah. Well, as long as it's not here.
Right.
But nuclear war is not. And of course, you still have absolute pacifists to still make the argument that war, you know, all forms of war are wrong. Okay? That's the first major category. The second major category behind warfare comes out of some of these themes. God is on our side. God approves of this. The idea of total evil and the confrontation with evil. Okay? And so the second major theme is the holy war concept. And that's exactly what it means. Okay? God fights for us. We fight for God. God is on our side. The faithful will be victorious. God will bring victory. You know, all those sorts of images. The problem with it is that what it creates, what I like to call, I'll just write this down, a moral dualism, okay? Which is just a fancy term for saying holy war involves an opinion that our side is totally good. So what does that mean the other side is totally evil? Yes.
Wasn't that meant theosophically, though, at one time, rather than the physical war?
Well, say more.
Meaning that if you're not a Christian, I'm going to go to war with you to convert you.
Well,
that does not necessarily mean I would kill you.
Well, that's another dimension of holy war. Because if you're in the confrontation with evil, for whatever reason, say they're unchristian, that makes them evil, okay, or anything else, it doesn't really matter. As long as you are operating under the assumption that my position, whether it's political or religious, is the right one, completely right, the other one's not, therefore that makes mine good and theirs evil. They really only have two choices. The first one you mentioned, what is one choice they have?
Conversion.
Now, if they're not going to do that, what's the second choice?
Wipe them out.
Get rid of them.
Battle?
Yes. In a holy war context, or you might call them, they say, a total war context, that's really the only options that are available. Because if the other side represents total evil, I mean, you don't want them around. So the only option left for them is to convert to your side, because then they'll come over to the good. Now, what really makes it messy is if both sides believe that. See? So if we're fighting somebody that we label as total evil and we're total good, and the other side thinks they're total good and we're total evil, and each side is waiting for the other to convert, nobody's going to convert to the side that they think is totally evil. I mean, at least I don't think so. Okay?
That's when the art of negotiation comes in.
Well, the problem with this, though, in this context, is it's very difficult to give total evil options. Because the only one you want to give them is the conversion option, or to take our side, whatever that happens to be. Okay. Let me give you a couple of examples of this. From popular culture, which is something else that I look at a lot. You all seen the Star Wars, all three of the Star Wars films with Darth Vader and those people. Okay. If you've seen those, you know who represents total evil. I mean, if you look at Darth Vader, I mean, you cannot associate goodness with him at all. Okay, or the Emperor a little bit later on in the third film. The enemy is almost always presented as formless, faceless, certainly dehumanized, okay, in a total war context, okay, and that obviously justifies their killing. I'm going to talk about killing a little bit later on in the week too, okay, more forcefully. Another good example of this is you all watch Star Trek? Any Trekkies in here? Closet Trekkies? From the old shows with Kirk and those guys, not the new one. Okay, that's okay, but the old, it doesn't have the
new one's a little different.
Yeah, it is. But the older one, who represented ultimate evil? Yeah, the Klingons. And they were, and look at their qualities. I mean, they were ruthless. They were bloodthirsty, they were fascist, and they weren't very nice people. I mean, they weren't polite even, I mean, you know. So you begin to characterize the other side in almost entirely negative terms. So what you do is create this sort of barrier between purity and impurity. And the other side is almost always identified as being impure. And you don't want that to, think of it as contamination. And you don't want that. So the holy war perspective can be particularly PBS. Okay. Is there anyone who hasn't? I should maybe put it that way. Okay. There's the one of the episodes talks about Sherman and his famous march from Atlanta to the sea. And of course, what's Sherman's quote about war? That we all know. War is hell. But what does that mean? What does he mean by that?
Anything goes.
Sherman's point was this: I didn't start this war, and I can't even end it. The only thing that can end it is what? Who can end the war?
The South, like a vigilant.
That's it. That was his argument. And if they want it, I'm going to give them enough of it so that they'll quit. So in other words, the way to achieve a victory was the Southern surrender, and you can do anything you want to bring that about. And that's essentially what Sherman meant by that.
And that's what we did in World War II.
Well, there's a lot of argument about that in terms of what constituted victory. See, part of the problem in terms of thinking about warfare is what are your aims? I mean, if victory comes, how do you know it? What does it look like? One of the difficulties about Vietnam was precisely along those lines. And in other words, what would it mean, what would it have meant to have won? I mean, would we know it when it happened? I mean, that's kind of the ambiguity about warfare. I mean, you want victory, but you need to define clearly, or at least have some understanding of what that means. Okay?
You didn't have, I don't think you had an opportunity for that in Vietnam and in World War II. In World War II, we had unconditional surrender. There was no way you were going to get that in Vietnam, fighting the war we were fighting.
Well, but part of that's the difference in terms of what we understood winning to be.
Yeah, the same thing in Korea. I mean, we did away with a general that was a military might that won us a victory, and so to speak, in World War II. Cool.
Yeah, MacArthur.
But they did away with it in Korea so that they could get more or less a political.
Well, but I think part of the difficulty, I think, is that we often associate victory with unconditional surrender or with the total defeat of the enemy. Well, and one way to think about it might be, well, maybe they're different. Maybe there's a different kind of victory there. I mean, I'm not claiming there is or there isn't, but I think that we often become sort of, very narrowly focused on an understanding of victory that entails that you fight wars in a certain way to achieve that end. That'll come into the third part when I talk about just war, but that's part of the problem. Because in the holy war mentality, or the holy war perspective, there is only one kind of victory, fundamentally. And that is maybe two kinds. We're talking about defeat and conversion. But really, they're both the same thing in the mind of each side, see. For us to convert to evil would be a defeat.
Well, the war, particularly in the Southwestern Pacific, was probably closer to a holy war than the one in Europe, although there was an evil command there. There were still Christians that you were fighting.
There's a great book that deals precisely with that. It's by a guy named John Dower, Dower, and it's called War Without Mercy: Race and Politics in the Pacific. And it's a remarkable analysis of the fighting in the Pacific in World War II. So yeah, and he talks a lot about that, the different cultural perceptions in terms of who the enemy is and how you view them. A lot of the understanding of the Holy War in terms of this moral dualism, it does work a little bit better with other cultures or other races, where you can attach that evil label to them much more easily. You know, one of the things I mentioned, the Civil War. I mean, one of the things that makes the Civil War so tragic, well, you all have read that. You know, if you read Civil War novels or see Civil War films, what is the singular plot device that epitomizes the tragic nature of that warfare? That's it. Okay? And the typical scenario is that one brother is on guard duty, right? At night or something, in the light of the full moon and across the river, he sees who? He sees his brother. So what's he going to do? Okay. Now, when you have enough of a distinction between the sides who are fighting, then those kinds of issues aren't even going to surface. Okay. So you see that in terms of the Holy War. What you get, let me just draw this conclusion, and then we'll move on to the last part, and then we can talk some more. What you get with the Holy War basically is essentially, I'll just do this kind of graphically for you, a separation. This is war, and here's ethics. Okay. What you get is really, I'm running out of stuff. What you get is essentially a complete separation between war and ethics. That's really what Holy War means. And that's what the phrase, you get this big barrier here between the attempt to bring ethics into warfare from a Holy War perspective is simply an exercise in futility. There's no connection between them. All's fair in love and war. Now that means it's not fairness, it simply means you can do anything you want. That's what that phrase means. All's fair in love and war. Okay. There's a third category, and I would suffice it to say that if you just took Christians as a numerical category, most Christians are not pacifists, and most are not holy warriors. I think that would be a true statement. If you just took a head count, right? I think that's true. So you have the two sides, pacifism on one hand and holy war on the other, and most Christians aren't in either one of those categories. So they've got to be somewhere in between. Okay. So if you think about it, then again, I'll maybe do this graphically. What is that in between? How can we talk about warfare that's not either one of those two things? What's that?
Where the rationalization comes in.
So what do you mean? Say a little bit more. What rationalization in what sense?
You can think, well, yeah, here is a reason why I can, and so you can make a reason.
Right.
Quite often influenced by propaganda and whatever.
Well, are they all rationalizations? Rationalization implies that the reasons are fictitious or phony or not good ones. And we've got to figure out a way to get around that.
Ideally or actually? Ideally, yes, they're all rationalizations. Actually, there again, you've got to separate them somehow. Okay. Or we do separate them.
If you truly believe what you're fighting for, then I don't think it can be a rationalization. You have to truly believe that you are right in what you're doing.
Okay, but Holy War people believe that too. So what's the difference between that approach and one that's not that, but yet still talks about warfare?
Well, I think it's the difference between war in Europe, for instance, and war in the Pacific during World War II. War in the Pacific could have been a holy war. War in Europe was a fight for a specific reason, to reduce the expansion of fascism or Nazism in Europe. So in one case you have a reason. In the other case, you're fighting a
ideology?
Well, fascism is an ideology. So I think what we're getting at here is an important point. In other words, pacifists would argue there are no reasons for war.
At any time.
At any time. Or at least a complete pacifist would, all right? Holy war would argue, basically, it's anything. Now, in between that is the assumption that, well, maybe some reasons are good ones and some are bad ones.
The Pacific War, we were fighting to protect ourselves, so to speak.
Well,
look at what's going on here. You're both giving it the idea of the notion of a just war.
The two big things between the European and the Pacific War, in Europe, you were scared when you were fighting, but so was the enemy. In the Pacific, the enemy had no fear.
Well, that involves in terms of the nature of the warfare itself.
That's the warfare itself.
Yeah. But the reasons for going and the way you evaluate the war, this brings us into this middle ground. I don't want to say it's precisely in the middle in terms of a median between holy war and pacifism. But what you've got is the development of an idea that says, well, wait a minute now. We can't argue that all wars are bad. Okay? We're not going to take that position. But we're not going to argue that we can do anything we want in warfare. We don't like that one either. So we've got to come up with reasons or criteria or conditions that allow us to determine the difference between wars that are right and wars that are wrong, or, as the theory has come to be known, wars that are just and wars that are unjust. So basically, the third category, or the third major sort of attitude toward warfare, is the just war theory. And just war theory really was an attempt to try and resolve that dilemma. In other words, are we going to be completely pacifist? And most Christians answered no. Now, there are reasons for that, obviously. A lot of them have to do with politics, but that's okay. And he said, well, we don't want to be holy, we don't want to be holy wars either. So we're going to fight. And there are going to be wars, and we might participate in them, but we've got to have some ability to discriminate between the ones that are acceptable and the ones that aren't, or the ones that are just and the ones that are unjust. And that's really what just war theory is. And as I said, that's a third major category. What you've got graphically, really, is an attempt to move ethics over into warfare. Not completely. In other words, you don't want to make the two the same thing. So ethics overwhelms war. That would really sort of be a pacifist position. But what you've got, we'll move this over a little bit, you've got some kind of intersection in here where ethics and war meet. And what you have then is a way to define limits or boundaries around warfare. And if it's within those boundaries, then it's considered just. And if it's outside of those boundaries, then it's unjust. So what just war theory is, think of it as a boundary or a fence. And inside the fence, there are certain conditions and criteria that hold, that govern warfare. Just war theory argues war is a rule-governed activity. Okay? And if you go outside of the fence and fight outside those limits, then you're moving into an unjust war.
Yeah. But who determines the location of the fences?
Well, that's part of simply the development of the theory itself. Because what you have historically is an attempt to do exactly that. What counts as a good reason for going to war? And as I said, tomorrow I'll go through the criteria really specifically for it, people, if you're going to be around tomorrow. But essentially what you've got are conditions or criteria that have to be met, and they're public. In other words, these are open to debate, and they've been around and debated for a long time, really essentially starting with Augustine. And Augustine was arguing, well, what's a good reason to go to warfare? Why should we fight? What's a good reason for fighting? There is one that's tended to dominate. Self-defense. That's the basic key justifying reason for going to war. So in terms of just war thinking, almost all defensive wars are just, almost. And almost again, almost all offensive wars are unjust.
Supposedly, I'm thinking of being attacked.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's it. It has to be a physical, the idea behind just war theory is it's not as if you don't like your neighbor or you can't stand them or hate them. You can't attack them, even if you do hate them. If they attack you, you can defend yourself and fight back. That's the basic primary underlying condition of just war theory. Yeah?
Well, that was the Jews' reason for attacking the Egyptians in 1956, that now they were defending themselves. Of course, they blew up all the Egyptian airplanes on the ground.
Oh, that was the 67.
They were defending themselves.
Yeah, the 67 war. Well, as I said, almost all defensive wars are considered just, and almost all offensive wars are considered unjust. Within the theory, there are certain exceptional conditions. That's where they talk about preemptive strikes, where if the attack is imminent, you don't have to sit and wait for it. Okay, but then there's ambiguity about that. The point about just war theory is that war becomes rule-governed, and those rules are both moral and procedural. It governs reasons for going to war, and it also governs how you fight. And again, as I say, I think tomorrow I'm going to talk about this a little bit more specifically in detail. So not every reason for going to war is a good reason. And you have to be able to discriminate between that. As I said, it became a problem for Christians when, mainly as a result historically of Constantine, and Christians assuming more and more political power, and becoming involved in politics and leadership and that sort of thing, and having to deal with these questions. You know, face it, if you're a small group that doesn't have any political power, okay, really, I mean, you know, you don't have to deal fundamentally with issues of warfare. I mean, you might have attitudes and evaluations about it, what you think about it. But once that changes, that political situation changes, then the waters become a little bit more murky. And now you might argue, well, we still got to maintain our earlier beliefs and attitudes about warfare, and that's an argument. Others might say, well, no, we can't do that now. I mean, things are different. We got to look at it in another way. But the idea was to think about when and how Christians could go to war. And also the need then to put limitations around warfare to regulate the amount of violence that took place. That's another thing that just war theory tries to do, okay? Let me just make a couple more quick comments, and then I'll take some questions if anybody has anything more to say, since we're running out of time here pretty soon. The criteria have been expanded and refined historically. A lot of it's codified in international law now, specifically the major one being the Geneva Convention of 1949. Okay, that was formulated after World War II. Most Christian denominations today are not pacifist, at least as official denominational positions. They really are somewhere in terms of just war thinking, most of them. Okay. It's just war theory or something like it. This is the one more interesting thing, and then I'll stop. The legal status of this is really interesting. Just war theory has absolutely no legal status at all. I mean, in the United States, none. The only recognized legal, in terms of legislative acts by Congress, the only legally recognized position in terms of opposition to warfare is complete pacifism. Just war theory has no basis at all. You cannot argue, let me give you this quick example. They don't have draft boards anymore, but if they were around and you went to your draft board and said, I want to be a conscientious objector, and they would say, well, why? And they say, well, I think this is an unjust war. Forget it. You have no legal ground to stand on. You could only claim conscientious objection if you were a total pacifist. So that's kind of the interesting irony. Where most Christians fit in terms of the thinking about warfare, there's no legal basis for it at all. It's the pacifist one that has the legal standing. Well, I'll stop since we're going to run out of time, or maybe we have already. Any other questions or comments? We could go on and on and on for this, and I will be for the rest of the week. So tomorrow I'll be doing, what am I doing tomorrow? I wrote it down. I am going to talk, can war be just? And we'll look really specifically at the criteria of just war. And I think that's, Bobby, you know, is that tomorrow morning I'm doing that? I forgot my, I think I have my schedule with me. Okay, yeah.
You know, it would seem there would be good foundation for not making a just war legal. And that being that if you made it legal, then you would lose control of the warrior. He's here today, but not tomorrow.
Well,
it does
more than that. I think you're exactly right. It does more than that, though. Look at what just war thinking does. It gives people ultimate power over whether or not to go to war. Because it's the discriminatory ability that it grants. This war, but not that war. This war, but not that war. Can I be a little cynical? No government's going to give its people that kind of power to make those discriminations and to simply choose which wars they will fight. I mean, that's an incredibly politically powerful if people have that capability. Yeah.
This is where it's more and more important for Christians to be in the government.
Well, I mean, you could argue that they are now.
They are, but not real Christians.
Well, you see, how do you resolve the dilemma then? I mean, is it the case of getting, this is part of the debate, all we need is more Christians in politics and it will be better, and other people say, forget it. You know, I mean, so, anyway, somebody else had a comment or a question?
Well, that's almost like saying our legislators need to be pacifists. I mean, you can look at that.
Yeah, well, that's the implication. I mean, the implication from saying that we need more Christians in government is precisely that. And then we wouldn't have all these wars. Yeah, up on the balcony.
Well, I just had the idea that I think it's significant that we're not trained to think. Our government doesn't do that through our public school system. And to think critically, I went to a seminar at BLU last February on faith and ethics in the workplace. And that was the consensus was that we are not taught how to think ethically. And you would think something as important as that, we would be. But now I can see why we're not. Because they don't want us not signing up.
You mean they don't teach Christian ethics anymore in Christian college?
Well, I'm talking about, mainly, like the public school system.
Well,
they give us civics class in the ninth and tenth grade, but they don't teach us how to think about, how we are to act. We're just supposed to act. We're supposed to do what we're told.
Yeah. Well, part of just war theory is precisely that. As I said, I'll say more about the criteria tomorrow, but the idea is that it is public. It's not secret. In other words, it's not as if the leaders just simply have this and they'll say, well, let us look at this and don't tell anybody. You know, I mean, the idea behind just war theory is to create a moral debate about warfare. Now, obviously, pacifism, too. Holy war, too, but in a slightly different understanding of sort of what ethics involves and implies and entails. Well, we're going to run into dinner in about 5 minutes, so I don't know if they're still taping, but if they are, they can stop now. And as I said, I'll leave the books up here for a little bit, and if anybody wants to look at them or ask about the books or any other books, I'll be glad to hang around for a little bit.